If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
Welcome to Back in America, the podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Back in America, your podcast questioning American identity, culture, and values. I'm your podcast editor, Josh Wagner, and today I'm here with Justin Bernstein, a professor of biomedical ethics at Florida Atlantic University. Justin's research delves into political legitimacy, vaccine ethics, and personal responsibility towards global ethical challenges. Welcome to Back in America, Justin.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
Glad to be here.
Definitely. I'm excited to talk to you today. What does this question of vaccine ethics entail for you?
I'll give you a big picture of what I think is going on with vaccine ethics. So vaccines have two functions. First, they protect individuals. And second, they protect populations. And each of those raises distinct sets of ethics questions. Because vaccines protect individuals, we might view them as a really valuable resource in the same way that we view, say, like ventilators. Remember, in the spring of 2020, there was a lot of debate about who should get a ventilator when there's a shortage. And I was part of a team that was designing recommendations for who should get to have a vaccine first. When we allocate the vaccines, we ended up settling on, among other people, like medical workers, people over a certain age, those sorts of things. Because the thought is, this is a valuable resource that lots of people will want, and we should make sure that people who really need it get it first. The other function of vaccines, this sort of population protection, raises a different set of questions, especially when you think about vaccine mandates, where we require people to get vaccinated, not just to protect them, but to protect the population as a whole. So it's kind of this strange area of ethics because you both have this valuable resource that everybody wants. And on the other hand, it's like, what could justify the government forcing people to take this valuable resource that is good for them, but the reason that we're forcing it on them is primarily to protect the population as a whole. And so the way I think about this is that the former question about who should get it first is a question of justice. The latter question of, is the state permitted to mandate a vaccine? A question of legitimacy. What gives the government the right to require this of people, that they allow for a relatively invasive, it's incredibly safe, and it's not that invasive, but it is an invasive medical intervention. So what could permit the government to require people to allow that? So that's what I take this two sides of vaccine ethics to be all about. We were mainly thinking about the sort of first question, the justice question. Now I'm starting to turn a little bit more to thinking about the second question about mandates. So should we, for instance, mandate a COVID-19 vaccine for healthcare workers in the way that some places have mandated a flu vaccine?
So there are things that we all believe are generally good. Climate change is real. We should probably try to reduce emissions. But at the same time, it seems that belief doesn't really carry through my actions. And something in terms of the COVID-19 vaccine, this seems somewhat objectionable. The people I'm around all believe in the science. They say, hey, we should probably all stay inside. We should all wear masks. We shouldn't travel. And yet a lot of them, that's what they're doing. How would you reconcile this difference? Or how would you explain the reasons why a belief does not actually play out in action? Why is it such that the thing about using Amazon seems fine, not wearing a mask, it seems more objectionable?
So I actually am not as convinced of an assumption which a lot of people make, which is that making the decision with regard to Amazon is okay, or that it's importantly morally different from the decision not to wear a mask or something like that. So here's some of my work that I've been thinking about. So I have a paper that's under review that's called In Defense of Conscious Consumption, Why You Can't Have Your Steak and Call for Political Action on Climate Change Too. That paper sort of argues that just as we have reasons to contribute to broader political efforts to sort of solve climate change, we have reasons to change our own habits or consumption decisions because doing so contributes to the emergence of social norms or informal sorts of rules that are integral to combating climate change. And you can apply that sort of line of argument to a host of other collective action problems where basically there's a really bad outcome that results from lots of people behaving in a way. If we were all to behave in a different way, we would avoid that really bad outcome. So clearly, people not social distancing is a case like this. If more of us were to take social distancing seriously, then we would be in better shape with regard to the pandemic. I think that one of the reasons that you ought to, as an individual, socially distance has less to do with the direct risk you impose on others, although that is a reason. It also has to do with establishing social norms about how we ought to respond to the pandemic. So part of what you should be doing, like mask wearing or not going on vacations, has to do with contributing to this broader informal norm that people will hopefully start to comply with as time goes on. And I think the same thing is true for getting vaccinated. I mean, I think there are good reasons to get vaccinated in itself, but I also think there are reasons to publicly get vaccinated because that sends that sort of signal or message to the rest of us. I'm a big NBA fan. Lakers legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar allowed himself to get filmed getting the vaccine. Current Spurs coach Greg Popovich, same thing. So having publicly sort of conveying that you have trust in the vaccine and that you're following these sorts of recommendations is, I think, important because it can help create social norms.
So I think maybe it's more related to the climate change example, but there also is a way in which individual action matters very little. Wherein, like, looking at emissions, it's like 70% of a company. And like, sure, I have some emissions, but if everyone I know and every human being in America stopped using cars, it still would not make a dent in the overall emissions. Or how would you weigh these two different things?
I do think it would make a difference if everybody in the United States were to stop using an internal combustion engine car. I mean, I think that would actually make a dent. So this includes not just climate change, but also things like consuming products from like a factory farm. Those factory farms are huge. Your decision to buy a chicken breast at the grocery store almost assuredly makes no difference as to whether a particular chicken will be brutally raised and then brutally killed. So, I mean, I actually think that the case of getting vaccinated, wearing a mask is actually more similar to those sorts of things than people want to acknowledge. Some of my work before the pandemic was thinking about our reasons to get vaccinated against measles, mumps, rubella. One person going unvaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella, it's certainly possible that you can infect somebody else, but the actual risk individually considered is actually strikingly low. And I argue in some work that's about to come out that why would we get, I mean, people get really upset in response to MMR refusers. Like MMR refusers get hate mail. There's lots of public outrage directed towards them. Given that those individuals aren't imposing that much risk, how can we make sense of their moral obligations to say get vaccinated, moral obligations that they're violating? I argue that we have to understand it in terms of they're failing to comply with a widely accepted rule or norm or law that itself provides a collective benefit. The ethics of it has less to do with the individual risk that you impose on others, because in the grand scheme of things, it's relatively small. It has more to do with like broader social context, whether you're undermining the emergence of social norms that will be really beneficial, or whether you're violating a rule that others are complying with and is thereby providing all of us with a benefit.
What if your rule's wrong?
Let me see if I can come up with an example like this. Let's say a rule starts to emerge, like we should only drive like Teslas. I mean, there's certain respects in which that rule might be a gain, but it also would be exorbitantly expensive for people from less affluent backgrounds. And then we might worry that people from less affluent backgrounds are being shamed for not driving a Tesla or something like that. So you could have a case like that. It's the same sort of worry that we have about whether a policy is bad. We have all kinds of legislation that we look back at and we say, that was a terrible mistake. We shouldn't have enacted that legislation. And so what you just have to do is you have to be on the lookout to make sure that laws or informal rules are realizing requirements of justice. They're not regressive or disproportionately burdensome on unfairly disadvantaged members of our society.
Yeah. And I guess what I'm getting at is this question of whether you believe universal justice, whether it's just for someone, just for everyone, or whether there is a different class of people. So like in this Tesla example, what's just for wealthy elite is not what's just for low-income family.
Yeah, I would think that a flat tax is not just, even though it does involve everybody paying the same percentage of their income, or, you know, you could imagine everybody just pays $100. I would think that would be unjust, even though it would involve the same sort of requirement imposed on everybody. So justice isn't just the same sort of rule for everybody. It's going to have to be sensitive to features about their different situations.
What would be the ideal rollout for the vaccines? Who should get them first?
So this document I was a co-author on, I believe we recommended that healthcare workers, people above a certain age, people in elder care facilities would get first priority. As time has gone on, I mean, I'm not 100% convinced that that's right, because I think there are a lot of other essential workers who are at very high risk. So people like grocery store workers, people who work in food processing plants, agricultural laborers. So agricultural laborers in many contexts, they go to their work site, which is they all have to stand 6 feet apart, but then they get back into the bus that takes them back to their communal barracks and they're all sleeping next to each other. And moreover, those individuals, you know, they're providing a vital service for our country as a whole, and they're not compensated in the same way that at least some healthcare workers are compensated, and they don't have access to PPE or medical care in the same way that those healthcare workers do. I mean, I think there's a really powerful case to be made that we should equally prioritize certain other essential workers and not just healthcare workers when it comes to who could have access first. Another really controversial issue is that we've seen, tragically but also predictably, that the people who have suffered the most deaths disproportionately have been people from Latinx, Black, and Native American sorts of backgrounds. It's I say tragic because, but also foreseeable, because, you know, the reasons why people from those sorts of backgrounds are dying at greater rates is because of background injustices that already was leading to unequal health outcomes. This raised a sort of debate amongst us whether should we take something like race or ethnicity to be a factor when deciding who should get a vaccine first. We ultimately decided no, partly because one of the reasons that individuals from those backgrounds are at higher risk is that they're disproportionately occupying higher risk jobs. But also, just from like a legal and logistics point, we thought that could be a potentially a nightmare for very good reasons. You know, for instance, some Black Americans are vaccine hesitant because it seems like they know of the long and sordid history of medical abuse and government deception. So things like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, the inequities that we see in terms of quality of care received on the basis of race, awareness of those things is correlated with vaccine hesitancy. That's been pretty well documented. And so saying, hey, we want to give this vaccine to you first, in light of that history and the understandable hesitancy and distrust, I thought at least that that might backfire.
I'm in California right now. One question that a lot of people are dealing with is that one way that we're rolling out is based on age. If you're over 65, then you get the vaccine and everyone else has to wait. But there are lots of people who are more risk averse to get COVID, who are immunocompromised, who have other disabilities that mean that they have to stay at home, they can't work. How do you navigate between these different kinds of moral claims?
I'm open to the possibility that people in elder care facilities might not be entitled to the same extent as somebody who's immunocompromised or somebody who's at greater risk in virtue of occupying a certain job. This gets into incredibly hairy territory again, where, I mean, there's a big debate about how should we allocate ventilators in the spring that was like, well, if we're trying to save the most number of years of life, if you're just deciding between a 40-year-old and a 60-year-old, if you say we should always try to save the younger person, there's a complaint that that's ageist. And this is where the rubber meets the road. I don't have a great answer about how to resolve that difficulty. What I will say is I am sympathetic to people who make an argument like the following. When we're in a pandemic and we're choosing whose life we should save, we're basically deciding who should get years of life. This is a scarce resource in this context. People above a certain age have enjoyed that resource to a large extent. So you could imagine a case where it's like we have an immunocompromised patient who's 30 and somebody who's in their 70s, all else equal, I'm sympathetic to the argument that we should favor the 30-year-old, given that they haven't gotten to enjoy the life years that the 7-year-old has. I'm sympathetic to that argument, but it's a very controversial argument. I hardly claim that it carries the day.
Yeah, and I think I have concerns about that line of argumentation. One is that it seems like the people who are spreading the disease the most are people in that age bracket, in 25 to like 35. Obviously, probably a person who's immunocompromised is not the one spreading it out, but why should they be the ones who's benefiting earliest and the most?
Your point about like the people who are spreading it, I mean, I think it's really interesting. So this is a case where the two functions of vaccine that I mentioned and the questions about who should get it kind of come apart. So from a population perspective, if we had enough vaccine, if we were trying to minimize the spread, there's a scenario where I could see someone saying, well, if we find that the vaccine is in fact effective enough at preventing transmission spread, there's been some news about that recently. It's still not entirely clear. If we find that, there could be a population health argument for saying we should vaccinate the college kids who are unlikely to socially distance and who are going to go out and spread the disease. If you think that people should not be rewarded for going out and spreading the disease, or if they could take steps to not spread the disease, it seems odd to like, well, let's give them the vaccine since they're going to go out and behave in these ways, which we think they should not be behaving.
Yeah. So I think a more like personal question here is like, what do you do with people who are like flouting these like recommended CDC guidelines? What do you do as someone who's seen this happen? Like, do you like shame them into doing it? Is that a good way to build ethics?
You know, just because you've been vaccinated doesn't mean it's not possible for you to transmit the virus. So you should still be concerned. I mean, for the reasons why we think you should wear a mask, those reasons still apply, right? It's not just about protecting you, it's about protecting other people. So those reasons still apply. And if you're like, oh, I got the vaccine, now I can just go spit on stuff everywhere and, you know, just sneeze with my hands to the wind, that would be really problematic. As for the shaming point, there's a worry about regressive effects here. Some people who are going out and just partying. So I live in Florida. Florida is very different different than California during this pandemic. Right now, I mean, I can drive by a bar and there are people inside just hanging out. It's pretty terrifying. I think that some of the people who are not social distancing or not wearing masks fall into that category. And if shaming were only directed at them, I think there'd be something worrisome in the sense that there's always something worrisome about shaming, but maybe it could be justified. The real worry is that there's a lot of information coming out that some of the people who aren't social distancing aren't doing so because they live in tiny apartments. Disproportionately, people from lower income backgrounds who can't really work from home as effectively. This gets back to, would we just be shaming people because they can't afford a Tesla sort of point? Would we be shaming people just because they social distancing is far more burdensome on them than it is on other people? That would be very problematic. The trick is to find a way to encourage the relevant kind of behavior and make it expected that that's the behavior without that somehow leading to stigmatizing and penalizing people for whom it's really burdensome. Last thing I'll say about this is to that end, I mean, I think to make it less burdensome, we need the government to step up in ways, as we're all seeing, it's kind of failed to step up. There should be a lot more aid going to people who are in need right now for whom social distancing isn't as feasible because they're giving up a lot for the sake of the public good. A co-author and I have a paper where we argue that we should think about the ethics of giving money in a pandemic should be thought of in terms of obligations of reciprocity to people who've taken on large burdens. So some of us working from home is not fun. Social distancing is not fun. It's psychologically very difficult. However, there are other people who are like giving up serious goods. So young children, especially young children from lower income backgrounds who rely on schools for various social services for whom distance learning isn't as feasible. Them staying at home is doing something for the sake of the public good. They're not getting compensated for it. For those of us who are in a position where we can, we argue that you owe it as a matter of like reciprocity rather than like say charity or just helping somebody who's in need of help.
But so you think it's not a legal obligation that the government has to provide some compensation to like infant or?
Oh, I do think it's an obligation the government has. I think the government's failing to deliver on that obligation. It's sort of a question about, in a way, I mean, it's not vigilante justice, but it's sort of when the government is failing and it's failing in predictable ways to compensate people who are making their contribution to a public good. We argue that individuals who are able to have obligations of reciprocity compensate those individuals. Now, ideally, the government would be doing this, but since we know the government isn't doing it, we have reason to think it will continue to fail to do that. It becomes incumbent on the rest of us who are benefiting from this decision by other individuals. So here's an analogy that we use in this paper. So imagine that a community is going through a drought. There's a decision that you're not allowed to water your plants. It comes down from the mayor or whatever. For some of us, that'll be unpleasant. It means our lawns will die. But for a botanist or somebody whose livelihood depends on being able to water their plants, this is much more devastating for them than it is for the rest of us. Now, what could we do when it comes to the botanist? One thing we could do is we could allow them to water their plants, even though the rest of us are subject to a restriction. Another thing we could do is compensate them. Children from lower income backgrounds are contributing to a public good, analogously to how not watering your lawn is contributing to a public good, but they're not getting compensated. And so it's a matter of fairness that we step up and compensate them because we have a dysfunctional government.
I think maybe one question kind of underlying our opinion I'm trying to ask you is like, how do you make these decisions? So you've written some papers, you've thought this a lot, and I think it could seem like you're just waving your hand saying, I thought about it, and now suddenly essential workers should get it. I think that, you know, infants should be compensated in this way. What are you appealing, some kind of philosophical system or belief?
It's a great question. There's sort of two approaches that you might take to thinking about these ethics questions. The one is you take a view, utilitarianism or Kantian ethics or Rawlsian political philosophy, liberal egalitarianism, and you just plug that in and you see what comes out and you say, that's what we should do. What makes that hard is that none of these sort of philosophical views enjoy universal consensus. People disagree about it. And I think that that actually does raise interesting questions about legitimacy. So given that we all disagree about what should be done in those sorts of contexts, when people disagree in this way, we often think it's appropriate to allow for some sort of decision-making procedure that allows input from different representative groups and stuff like that. One way to go would be just what you might call the comprehensive route. The comprehensive route would be, say, here's the true ethical theory. Let's follow its implications. The other route would be to say, well, we need to have a procedure to resolve these sorts of disagreements about values. And what that procedure puts out will be what we take to be binding. And I'm inclined to think in this case, the disagreements are so deep that there are reasons to just allow people to deliberate and come to a consensus or something like a consensus with guidance from ethicists and other folks. We've created ethics frameworks where we say, here are the different sort of ethical values at play. So you mentioned, for instance, older people have made their contribution to society in a lot of ways. So it seems perverse not to prioritize them in some sort of way. That's like a consideration that gets listed in some sort of framework for vaccine allocation. They talk about it as terms of, you know, retrospective reciprocity or something like that. But you might think people who are going to make contributions to society, that'd be future looking considerations of reciprocity. So the task for ethicists during this pandemic, in large part, I think, is to articulate the different values at stake and to just spell out the implications of different decisions in terms of those values, making a final decision. I think that we're subject to such deep disagreements about this that it's not entirely the place of ethicists to say, this is the right answer. I mean, it might be in some cases where we could say, this is clearly the wrong answer. In general, we're going to have to allow some sort of democratic decision making. Now, that doesn't mean like Congress. So part of an interesting challenge is like, how do we come up with ways to reflect people's values that are not subject to the incredibly dysfunctional political system we have? And so I think that's a question that some of my co-researchers and I are really interested in exploring down the line.
Yeah. And I feel like you've almost preempted my next question, which was about why should the philosopher be the one dictating a policy versus someone signing for myself versus someone who's been in public health for decades?
Well, okay. There's this phrase that's kept coming up since the beginning of the pandemic. So I think Gavin Newsom said it. He said, science, not politics, will decide when we reopen. President Joe Biden just said that again recently. On the one hand, what I take those people to be saying is that, look, we're going to make a decision not on the basis of short-term partisan gain. That's noble. But I think it's also really misleading to think that science can resolve some of these questions on its own. As I've mentioned, there are trade-offs for a lot of these different decisions about policies to be made. So for instance, requiring children to stay at home certainly is probably very good from an epidemiological perspective when it comes to preventing the spread of COVID, but it's really bad from the perspective of those children's welfare. Public health experts can't tell you which one of those values we ought to prioritize. And in some cases, I think there's been this sort of unstated assumption that what we ought to do is whatever maximally reduces the transmission of the virus. That assumption needs to be argued for. You need to be doing philosophy or ethics if you want to say public health should have the final say here, because that's based on some pretty contentious ethics assumptions, just like the ones I've been discussing.
I think a big part of that is that it feels in some way that this whole idea of vaccine ethics is just putting a, not necessarily a price, but it's quantifying human life. To me, this seems very similar to this, the US government values each American's life at $10 million. One question here is like, why does that feel immoral or strange? Because it's something that you have to do. And so like, how do you get past that? And then I think the large question that we've been chasing here is how do you even start to think about that question?
Yeah. So, okay. So I'll start with the first question. And so it's funny, like, I think Governor Cuomo came out really early on in the pandemic and he was saying things like, we won't put a price on human life. And people are like, this is very inspiring. This is the leadership we need. Like what he said was like patently false. Like the government does that. And it would be really irresponsible for the government not to do that. So if we were to spend whatever it takes to save a life, that would be a not fair use of resources. So, I mean, yes, I think what makes this uneasy is that it's sort of two ethical perspectives were sort of alternating between when that happens. So one is this very micro level perspective where it seems really inhumane or cruel or ethically wrong in some other way to put a price on human life. The other perspective is this population level sort of public health perspective where it's like, well, we're thinking about populations and how well they do overall. We want the population as a whole to do well. And there's some interesting psychological work about people not being as willing to sign up for policies that would prevent deaths in the longer term as they are really expensive policies to save somebody's life when they're in dire need. I mean, we see our health system is built around this. Like if we provided people with care earlier, we would save a lot of money, fewer people die, but we're like really willing to fund the really expensive treatment down the end of the line. And this is something, or, you know, to give another example, we spend tons of money on like rescuing the single child who's trapped in the mine shaft. We don't spend the money on the guardrails around the mine shaft. And so in a way, I think that this is partly a product of this larger feature of our moral psychology or how we tend to think about these issues. If we were to invest more in preventive measures, that would be great. But thinking about which preventive measures to invest in usually requires taking this like, well, how many lives will we save? what's the price we should put on them? How do we weigh these sorts of things? And that's a very uncomfortable calculus for a lot of people to make. So I believe in the framework we authored, we suggested that there are four values that need to be balanced. And this is sort of a framework we use more generally for thinking about reopening and shutting down. Like the four values we talk about are overall well-being, justice, liberty, and legitimacy. And we just sort of say, look, here are the justice sorts of reasons that count in favor of prioritizing, say, people who work in essential but underpaid jobs. If we're thinking about saving lives from a welfare perspective, that might count in favor of vaccinating people who are old. So then you sort of canvas the reasons that count in favor of each of them. And then you just have to make a final judgment about how much weight we assign to these different sorts of reasons. Where should that put us? That's sort of the way in which we went about making those decisions when we made recommendations to the CDC. I mean, I think that's the best we can do when we're faced with basically like a dilemma when it comes to like who somebody's going to lose out, who should lose out. Making that decision, I think it's appropriate to articulate the different trade-offs, but I don't think that the values in question resolve those trade-offs decisively.
Along these lines, I'm really interested in like three fringe cases of people who may or may not have a vaccine earlier or later. One is like unhoused people who are sleeping on the street. You might think that they're a higher risk for getting COVID, transmitting it around. The second one is prisoners, people who are in jail, suspected of being terrorists or of killing other people, and that they're supposed to be undocumented persons.
Yeah, those are all interesting cases. I mean, I would think all three of those should be pretty high up on our priority list. So even if I don't get a vaccine, there are steps I can take to avoid exposing myself to the disease. If you are confined to a certain space where health protocols aren't being taken and you're thereby exposed to greater risk of disease, you don't have that option. It would be absurd to say that people who are in prison should have to just contract this disease because they committed crimes. Obviously, not all crimes are equal, but even like for pretty bad crimes, I don't think saying that it's an appropriate punishment that they should have to contract this deadly virus. That would be very wrong and inhumane. I mean, I would say that, yeah, they should be high up on the list, higher than somebody like me. My university is requiring me to teach in person, but where I'm mask, I can use hand sanitizer. Undocumented immigrants. It's interesting you bring that up because in the fall of 2019, we were seeing outbreaks of all kinds of diseases amongst undocumented children. This is incredibly cruel to subject people to those sorts of conditions. So again, it's sort of like if the state has decided that they are permitted to detain people, it's a similar sort of thing. If you are depriving people of the means to protect themselves, then you owe it to them. I mean, I do think that there are logistical difficulties. So this is another thing. Because it's a two-dose sort of thing. It's not like you can just drive around a city in a van and just vaccinate whoever you see. We need to have follow-up appointments and stuff like that. I think that poses a particular problem if people are housing insecure. But I still think like in principle, if those individuals wanted it and had access to it, and then there's no reason why they shouldn't be high up on the priority list, given that they're exposed to high risk.
Bringing us to the question of who wants the vaccine and who doesn't want the vaccine. I think you were raising earlier this question of like past injustices and human medical experimentation U.S. government has committed against Black and brown citizens as a very valid and real reason why people might not want to take the vaccine. I think to a certain extent, I think we're reading that maybe a quarter of health frontline healthcare workers are refusing the vaccine for some reason or another. That seems like a huge problem.
There's two kinds of mandates that are really salient. So one is a mandate that would be for all citizens, since we can all sort of do it. The other is a mandate based on professions. Something I've been thinking about is whether it's appropriate to mandate a vaccine for healthcare workers in particular. I just don't think it's very realistic or feasible to think that we could mandate a vaccine for all citizens. It's not feasible. So part of this is because many people have hesitancy right now who are ordinarily very pro-vaccine. If you're in California, you know this. Sometimes it dips below the 95% threshold, but around 94% of children who enter kindergarten on a given year, they usually have been vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella. The overwhelming majority of people support, or if not support, they comply with the measles, mumps, rubella mandate. It took a while to get there to build support for that. And many of those people who are fine with mandates for their kids are much more hesitant when it comes to this vaccine because of the speed at which it was developed, because of the political context. We heard Vice President Harris say at a vice presidential debate, if public health officials tell me to get vaccinated, I'll trust them. Otherwise, I don't trust like the government, like Trump, basically, to tell me when to get vaccinated. So there are these sorts of background factors that make hesitancy understandable, even though I think it's ultimately mistaken. We have overwhelming evidence the vaccine's safe and effective. I think that trying to mandate a vaccine when there's that kind of pushback is just not smart. It can backfire. I also think that there might be other less intrusive ways to try to get people to get vaccinated. So public information campaigns. It's not even like we have enough vaccine right now to I remain skeptical that vaccinating everybody is something that's realistic politically, or even there might be reasons morally not to support it. The other kind of case you're talking about, vaccinating, say, healthcare workers, I think it's trickier to make that case than a lot of people seem to think. Some hospitals and states have mandated the flu vaccine for healthcare workers, but I believe in many cases you're permitted to wear a mask if you decide to decline the vaccine. Right now, everybody's like, I believe everybody's being required to wear a mask. So appealing to that kind of precedent wouldn't straightforwardly show that a mandate, we're permitted to require people to get vaccinated even if they'd rather wear a mask. If we find out that the vaccine is very effective at preventing transmission, then the thought is, okay, you have an obligation to protect your patients. So we often appeal to these sorts of special obligations that physicians have or something like that. That will apply better to some healthcare workers than others. But I also think that how much do they need to minimize risk to their patients? So if you wear a mask effectively and you use PPE, you are at very low probability of transmitting the virus. So the question is whether that extra bit of protection justifies a mandate. I'm not sure that it's obvious that it does. You know, I think the real case is going to hinge on whether we think that there's something about the practice of medicine that makes it appropriate to require medical practitioners or healthcare workers to get vaccinated, but not these other sorts of groups. Healthcare workers right now are pretty burned out. If we want to not alienate them, if we want to keep them in their jobs, there might be reasons not to mandate a vaccine. We can't afford to lose them. And so, you know, doing something that would lead to people to quit or something like that, or would exacerbate burnout, I mean, also just because it might seem disrespectful, there'd be reasons not to do that. But figuring out whether that is the case, whether a mandate for healthcare workers would lead to a bunch of people quitting or something like that, that's a really interesting empirical question that I don't know anything about.
It seems that there, in general, that there is a distrust of public institutions. It's always preferable to have the private technocrat from Silicon Valley take something over than have Medicare or Obamacare or social service. But and so, like, there seems this contradiction between governing political libertarianism of America today and also this, like, need for public health and communitarianism. And, like, how do you balance those two things? And there is a very, like, explicit way in which, like, capital is propelling us to care about the individual over the community against community as, like, co-immunity. The only reason that vaccine works is that everyone gets vaccinated.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Somebody had a tweet, they were like, you know, there's the old saying, there's no atheist in the foxhole. Somebody said, there's no libertarian during a pandemic. But I mean, it's a good tweet, but it's not true. It's interesting that you mentioned this. The thing that got me really interested in the ethics of vaccination was a paper by really sharp libertarian philosopher, Jason Brennan. He said, okay, you could see how this could be a tension between, if you're a libertarian, how could you possibly support vaccine mandates? And then he tried to argue from libertarian premises to defend vaccine mandates. My first publication was arguing that he basically abandoned libertarianism to make the case. So he was talking about when you contribute to imposing collective risk of harm, you're violating other people's rights. The libertarian is really just about preventing rights violations. So the libertarian can consistently say that because when you go unvaccinated, you contribute to collective risk of harm, you're violating other people's rights. State is permitted to, you know, prevent people from violating each other's rights. I think that that's no longer recognizably libertarian because we can think of all kinds of ways in which people contribute to collective risk, but no principled libertarian would really support legislation in the relevant way. So legislation dictating what kind of cars you can drive, or you could imagine a case where if people were to take safety classes as adults, they might be less likely to engage in risky activities. No libertarian's going to count in like requiring people to take classes as an adult. I think you're right that there's this tension between libertarianism and sort of vaccine mandates. How do I resolve that? Well, one thing is I'm just not a libertarian. I mean, and there's some really, really sharp libertarians working in political philosophy right now, they probably wouldn't be persuaded by the argument I just gave, the argument I published. They might have other ways to do it. I think because each individual doesn't impose that much risk taken individually, I don't think there's a really promising argumentative strategy for the libertarian to claim that vaccine mandates are justifiable. So that leads the sort of other route you described, which is going much more in a communal direction. This doesn't show that we shouldn't go a democratic socialist or the sort of route that other countries go, where there's much more of an emphasis on what you might call the common good than there is in this country. But I mean, I don't even think you have to go there to make the case for requiring people to get vaccinated for certain diseases. So the idea would be something like, we think that it's the job of government to solve collective action problems, ensuring that we have access to clean air. Silicon Valley isn't going to ensure that. They don't have the right incentives to do it, and they don't have the power to do it. National defense, that's a public good. Most of us don't think that that should be provided by Silicon Valley or something like that. Here's the argument. It's the job of government to solve collective action problems that prevent us from enjoying vital public goods, enjoying herd immunity against diseases like measles, mumps, rubella, for instance. That's a vital public good. So it's the job of government to do it. Mandates are one way to do it. I think that there are other ways to do it too. There's interesting suggestions about like nudging people or choice architecture as a way to get people to get vaccinated. But that's the sort of argument I would make.
The underlying concern here is that the government is not doing it. And that vaccine, rather than a state of exception, is revealing the cracks in the system, the things that are slipping through anyway that are not being addressed.
So the argument I just made applies really nicely to measles, mumps, rubella. Right now, we're seeing government failure on a massive level. So, I mean, there's been some discussion about like, should employers do this privately? Are we going to rely on private institutions to solve this problem? I am incredibly pessimistic that that would work. Not all employers are going to do it. And this is a case where you need to get epidemiologists, actually you're saying around 70% of the population vaccinated. I have very little confidence that private institutions will be able without government to get to that level of vaccination. Even though our government is doing really badly, I think it's the best game in town for getting us to that point.
Returning to the question of vaccines and historical wrongs committed against like walking around communities, creating some kind of distrust for the vaccine, and you're providing a very practical solution is that give more time, let other people show it, have the kind of public demonstrations, make it a norm, which does seem very symptom-based level kind of resolution versus in like dealing with like the past misdoings. And I'm really thinking of that the part in like Anarchy State Utopia or Gnostic says there should be some kind of reparations for past harms. I don't know what's going to be, but something should happen. I think the question there is one of history, and that I'm just curious if you have any sense of how would you even begin to conceptualize that not.
Yeah. Okay, good. So you're definitely right that everything I was saying about building trust in the short term is like a short term. It's treating a symptom. And the thought is just, well, right now we are in an emergency. Ideally, we will solve the root causes. But I mean, as you're pointing out, we haven't done very well at that. If our plan for being the pandemic involves finally adequately responding to historical racial injustice, then that's not, I'm not optimistic that that plan will succeed. Just not because it shouldn't succeed, just because our, you know. So, I mean, in terms of how do we build trust back. And I mean, so there's sort of two questions you're asking. One is just a general, like what's owed as a matter of reparative justice or racial justice. And the second is how do we build trust with an eye to medical institutions in particular? I'll start with the second question. So I think that the best way to build trust is to be trustworthy, is to demonstrate that you are acting on behalf of people's best interests. There are good reasons for distrust. You don't have to consider all other sorts of aspects of racial injustice to see that Black patients, for instance, they get far worse care and have far worse health outcomes from their interactions with medical practitioners than people from other ethnic or racial backgrounds. Changing that would, I mean, presumably would lead to increase in trust, providing better care, those sorts of things. So I think that that's easier said than done. People are talking a lot about systemic racism. Systemic racism exists in the medical context. Rooting that out is going to be a long overdue, but it's going to take a lot of work. As for how to think about reparative justice and reparations more generally, I mean, I don't have a worked out view of this. There's really interesting contemporary work being done by a lot of philosophers in political philosophy about this, how we should think about it. I mean, I think that an interesting question is, so there's two kinds of concepts of justice that are relevant here. One is like, well, right now we have Black people enjoy shorter lifespans. They don't enjoy access to the same sorts of goods as white citizens simply in virtue of being Black. We know that. So one question is, you might say that that's just unfair, regardless of history. Forward-looking, people should not be disadvantaged on the basis of their race, gender, ethnicity, religion, all these sorts of things. So as people who care about equality, what Rawls calls fair equality of opportunity, similarly talented and motivated people should have similar life prospects in terms of their ability to gain goods that we all care about. You can just appeal to that to condemn the sorts of injustice you're talking about. That's very different from thinking about reparative justice or reparations, which is a inherently kind of backwards looking concept. So a test case that people sometimes talk about to illustrate this distinction is Oprah entitled to reparations? So on the one hand, Oprah is also disadvantaged in certain ways by these historical injustices. On the other hand, it sort of seems like, well, giving her a lump sum of cash, is that what's going on with that? Is that what we really need to do? Part of this depends on what aspect of justice you're looking at and what's required. So backwards looking versus forwards looking. I'm kind of the mindset that a lot of the backwards looking justice stuff, what really matters is like establishing relationships of respect and civic equality and things like that that have less to do with lump sums of cash. That said, I think the forward looking justice concerned, just ensuring that people have similar sorts of life prospects, that their life prospects aren't completely negatively affected by being a member of a racial group. I think those sorts of considerations count in favor of all kinds of measures that are talked under the banner of reparations. It might seem like an academic sort of distinction, but I think it's helpful to keep separate. What injustice are we responding to? Are we talking about past deeds or future looking deeds? I think it's or sort of future structural injustice right now that leads to unfair outcomes in the future. I think that the structural injustice can do most of the work. We don't even have to have the debate about, you know, what would be fair compensation for the unpaid forced labor and other sorts of abuses that happened in the past. You can still arrive at the conclusion we're in a radically unjust society and we need all kinds of changes in education, all opportunities, all those sorts of things without that sort of case.
And I have one last question, which is the question we ask all of our guests on the show, which is, what is America to you?
I don't know at this point. I mean, I think it's where I live. I don't have a great sense of like civic pride in being an American. I inescapably, it's part of my identity, but it's not something that I really endorse. So I used to live in Philadelphia and I loved Philadelphia and I was all about Philadelphia. I don't have that kind of feeling towards America, partly because we're incredibly politically polarized. It's also huge and abstract. It's, you know, hundreds of millions of people. It's harder to have a sense of belonging. So I guess, I don't know, what's America to me? I mean, I'm not really answering your question, but it's something that I feel very alienated from right now. I mean, one thing that I will say that's interesting is some people are talking about, maybe it's time to carve the country up. We have these deep disagreements about values and our government is really dysfunctional. Maybe there's not enough common ground for the current sort of makeup of the country and we could carve it up in certain ways. Obviously, $1 million question, how would that be done in a fair way that's acceptable to everybody? But philosophers like Alexander Guerrero have been talking about this sort of idea. Or maybe we could think about radically different forms of government, like using, again, Alexander Guerrero talks about this, like using like lotteries to select political representatives rather than holding elections or something like that. But yeah, right now it's a really dysfunctional country. It's a mess.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me about everything today. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure, Josh. Hopefully I answered your questions in the way that's helpful.